Hi, this is John Reed. Welcome to the second full edition of the Uncensored Week in Sports. Starting a little bit late today. Apologies. I think I lost one person in the chat room, but I am on now. So I'm in a little bit of a window before the Patriots-Bills game tonight. And just watching the Celtics with their hands full against the Orlando Magic. I had been telling a couple of my Celtics fans' friends that they have not played significant competition yet, and they were protesting, and I told them Orlando would be the first real test, and it seems to be. So the Celtics have come back from 20 points down, but they definitely have their hands full with this Orlando team anchored by Dwight Howard, and they may be the one franchise that's obviously you can point to that may be even a little better shape than the Celtics as far as having young Dwight Howard in the middle. The Orlando Magic maybe have a brighter future than our team, which has a few veteran years, and then who knows what's going to happen. But let's enjoy it while it's hot here in Boston is basically the message of that story. So the challenge I've imposed upon myself for my show is to only comment on things when I can add something to the dialogue that has not already been contributed. And that's not necessarily a real easy challenge, but that's what I'm going to try to adhere to on this show. So my commitment to you, the listener, is that what I'm going to say on the show, as much as possible, will not be a rehash of other opinions and perspectives you could have gotten elsewhere. So it's a high bar, and I might not hit it especially at first, but that's the goal that I'm trying to achieve here on these broadcasts. With that in mind, I was thinking a little bit about this show and sports in general and why sports matters to me. And I think I have kind of an unusual perspective on sports because on the one hand, I'm incredibly cynical about the commercialization of sports and the corporatization of sports. And that's going to be a major theme of the broadcast, is the way in which corporate sponsors have basically imposed themselves on our broadcast to the point that we don't even realize it sometimes. Just watching this Orlando Magic game and just watching all the sponsors come by, and the Fox NFL game I was watching was even worse, and I found myself wondering if any of these games, you know, are ever showed on classic sports in the future, and you're just going to see all these like companies being paraded upon throughout the game, little bulletin signs, sponsored moments, sponsored timeouts, sponsored game resets of companies that are merged or no longer in business, and it's just going to be an endless parade of sponsorships and kind of a unfortunate documentation of the degree to which we've allowed these games to be taken over. So I'm going to comment a little bit on that during these broadcasts, but at the same time, despite that, there's something about sports that still tries to and sometimes does transcend any of those encroachments. And so part of what I'm trying to do on my broadcasts is pay a little bit of tribute to those things about sports that allow us to rise above. And I think a lot of people treat sports as maybe an escape, a welcome escape from their work week. And I think to a degree that's probably true for me too. But I also look at sports myself as a way of learning about life and in particular learning about business. There's something about sports that does allow you to take lessons of how teams work and how athletes function within a team context that I think is relevant to success in business. And so I think that's an interesting aspect of sports, is how can you take lessons from sports and apply them to your life. And that, to me, is one of the reasons why I follow sports as closely as I do. And I would go so far as to say is a lot of the success that I have had in different points with business or leadership does come back to things from sports. And so that's something that means a lot to me about watching sports that I'll probably try to get across a little bit in my broadcast. And I also think about sports for me as sort of the last, I call it my last great agreement with American culture. And what I mean by that is you think about it and you're like, I can walk into a bar anywhere in the country, and as long as I'm not wearing my Boston sports colors and pissing someone off, I can pretty much talk sports with anyone and pretty much like fit in any social context talking about sports. And that's not really true of any other aspect of my life. I used to have this great agreement with music. I was born and raised on classic rock radio, and there was definitely a sense in which music at that time sort of had a collective appeal, a collective connection that would bind. Today, music is really scattered, and the corporatization of music is appalling, especially when it comes to rock and roll, which is almost a dead genre at this point, in my view. But however you want to look at music, there's no question that music has segmented and divided itself into subgroups and niches, and there isn't that same collective sense of experiencing music as a country the way, you know, America once experienced Elvis or the Beatles or even Led Zeppelin. So my last great agreement really is sports. Certainly politics couldn't be such if I walked into the average bar and started sharing some of my political views, I'd probably be in a fight within 5 minutes. Though that's not to say I want to pigeonhole myself as being some kind of a radical, because that's not necessarily the case. I think my political views would have a tendency to offend pretty much a broad spectrum of people from almost every political group. So I can only pigeonhole myself there, except to say that if I walked into a bar and started spouting those views, I would not find myself with many friends. So sports is really the one thing where I can kind of walk into any gathering and anywhere in the country and really just basically talk shop and just be one of the folks. Now, I guess I could say that to some degree about business, except that people a lot of times don't like to talk about work when they're not working. I like to talk about business, but there's a point at which talking about business just seems lame. So sports is really it. Sports is really the one thing that it's fun to talk about that I can really connect with people on. And so I think that's one reason why I pursue it, because otherwise I'm sort of this person on the fringes with these strange life philosophies and strange approaches to things. And I'm totally comfortable with that, but it's kind of nice to have something that you kind of share and agree with as far as everyone is concerned. Oh my God, someone just hit a huge shot as the quarter expired off the backboard for Boston, end of third quarter. That was a pretty cool shot. I think it was Rondo. Anyway, I'll have to check that out. But so that's something that sort of drives my interest in sports and why I do this particular show. So with that in mind, kind of looking back on the week in sports, and I think a lot of people have been wondering if I would say something about the Patriots and the Spygate, and I'm holding off on that partially because it's another one of those topics. I don't really know if I have a whole lot to add to Spygate. That hasn't been said before and said more compelling than I could say it. But I do think what's interesting is that in so many sports debates, who you're a fan of, it colors your view so much that you could almost tell who someone's a fan of by their point of view on a particular issue. Like with the Barry Bonds issues where, you know, Homer fans in San Francisco, basically the last people really defending Barry Bonds. So when you find people defending Barry Bonds, they're usually a San Francisco resident or someone who has been following Bonds or maybe a fellow athlete apologist. But so the same, I think, has been true of the Spygate scandal where, you know, people who love the Patriots have kind of, you know, closed up the barriers to the outside and kind of said, you know, screw you, this is our team. And then the people on the outside who are looking for a reason to hate the Patriots or whatever have their reason. So, again, I don't think you get much of a good dialogue there. So I guess I thought I could say a couple of things as a Pats fan who, you know, was pretty much embarrassed and saddened by the events of Spygate. You know, there's a certain ruthlessness about the Patriots that I can appreciate on a certain level, but it was definitely hard to feel like in some ways that those victories were tainted by some kind of unnecessary advantage. And that's one of the things that felt sad about it, is that it felt like it was unnecessary, and it felt like it was one more example of a leader, in this case Bill Belichick, who perhaps felt completely unaccountable, where the things that allowed him to be great and succeed were also his weaknesses in a sense. And so, you know, getting direct warnings from the NFL and then disregarding them just showed a level of arrogance that I personally felt was embarrassing to me as a Patriots fan. And for a little while there, I kind of sort of lost a little bit of faith in them as a team as a result of that. So that's just an honest perspective of me as someone who really loved the team and loved how they went about things. And this sort of felt like a little scuzzy to me. I kind of wanted to take a shower afterwards. And I don't know any Patriot fans who have said that or fessed to it. But there are some things that really bother me about it. I think the demonization of the Patriots has gotten to an extreme that has really prevented a really open discussion. And just as an example, I have yet to really see a really thoughtful dissection of what type of advantage this type of filming would provide you with. I'm not saying it's something that the Patriots should have done. I don't advocate it. I think it was wrong. But what kind of advantage did it really provide, especially when you understand that you're filming, legally filming defensive alignments the entire game at any rate? I've heard coaches talking about how some of those signals are even faked, and so to what degree are the Pats able to take an advantage and use it? And so that was something that was never really established. Now, I think any form of deception or achieved advantage over an opponent that is against the rules is unfair. So on that level, it almost doesn't matter. But I think a discussion of to what degree did that actually help the team is really a pretty relevant discussion, because there's all kinds of ways you can try to achieve advantage but end up not. One classic example from my past is that in high school, I stole a chemistry test. It's not something I'm proud of, but I did it at the time, and it was a final exam that counted heavily in the class. So a bunch of us got together and studied the test because we had an illegal copy of it. The end result of the illegal copy is that we ended up studying our butts off, because the way the test was ordered, it really didn't provide any obvious way of knowing how to ask. It was a lot of complex essay and analysis things, so we basically had to hit the books. Now, we did have a significant advantage in that case, but the irony was we studied like 10 times harder than we would have, and I actually only had half the test and ended up doing even better on the half I didn't even take, because I had studied so much as a result of taking the test. So I had attempted to achieve an advantage that I thought would make things easy, but in fact it kind of forced me to study my butt off instead. So, I think it's one of those things where it's like, okay, you achieved an advantage, but how much did it really help you? And so I think that's one of the things that has frustrated me a little bit about the Patriots debacle, is that there hasn't been a really thoughtful analysis, as far as I can tell, of how this really helps. People either say, well, it doesn't matter at all, or the Patriots are cheaters, and there has never been any real good discussion of to what degree does this help. But I must say, as the scandal has gone on and become sort of part of the season, that I've sort of developed also a bit of a awe for the ruthlessness of what the Patriots are trying to do. And there's something about that that in a weird way does inspire me. And I think that there's been this sense of like, well, okay, if you're going to imply that we got our rings through some kind of illegitimate advantage, we're just going to go out this season and completely destroy you. Now, of course, the Patriots have more weapons than they've had historically in some ways, so that's part of what's allowed them to dominate the way they have. But part of it is just a determined outlook that they have to show everyone. So I think it's kind of funny, because you say, well, a team really needs a motivation, and the Patriots have, in a sense, the ultimate motivation now. So as much as the scandal disappointed me, it's created an intensity, an undeniable intensity to this season, especially with the matchups with the so-called Colts, the league darlings, as far as so-called morality is concerned. The last regular season game, it did feel like almost like a Super Bowl. It wasn't quite that extreme, but it definitely, you could feel it in your gut. It was like, wow. And even if you're not a huge fan of either team, I heard people commenting that weren't even fans that were just like, wow, that's like gut-wrenching drama, and it really is. And so I guess the payoff from all this is that you get this season that suddenly there's so much on the line now, because it's the entire Pats legacy. And I think that's the bottom line on Spygate, is that if Spygate had provided the Pats with some kind of enormous competitive advantage, then why wouldn't they be struggling this season without that advantage, which they no longer have? So it's pretty obvious that whatever advantage it provided the Patriots was not significant compared to the overall approach of the team and the championship caliber of the team. So I think that's a fascinating discussion. I'm not going to try to have the last word on it, because I'm still looking for my ultimate perspective on myself, but I must admit I'm taking this bizarre fascination now with being a part of this and seeing a team that is just so determined to rip everyone's hearts out. And there's something about that that I admire, and I'm not sure exactly why, but I think it has to do with the fact that there's something about being decisive in life that's important, and I think the Patriots have figured that out. And as a contrast, when we watched the Celtics play the other night, they played the Heat, and they had a 15-point lead, but they could not close it out. Like, they didn't have necessarily that ruthless. You could kind of feel them relaxing into their lead. And that's a weakness in sports, and to a degree, I think it's a weakness in life. And so while I'm not necessarily comfortable with everything about the Pats season, that aspect of their mental game, I think, is really compelling, and it makes for great theater, whether you love them or hate them. So that's basically that. There's so many things I could comment on this week. Obviously, the whole Bonds indictment went down. I think the one thing I'll say about that is that the government's case, I don't know why they did this when they did. The government's case is no better than it was a year ago. And they're going to have a hard time convicting Barry Bonds of perjury, I believe, without Greg Anderson, his personal trainer, who I believe, had he flipped on Barry would be completely screwed. But Greg Anderson has refused to testify. So how is it the government's going to prove this perjury case? They have one test, one positive steroid test from Balco, but it's Balco that outsourced the test, and the outsourced information comes back without clear links between the names and the test results, and they have no witnesses. So I don't really understand the case. I was really happy to see Barry go down, but partially because I just think it's out of my kind of love for Hank Aaron that it was good to see Barry suffer the way he has around this, because I don't want Barry to own that record. That's just how I feel about it. But I don't understand the government's case, and if Barry ends up being acquitted of this, it will almost help him and kind of lay even more credibility to the idea that he's a bit of a martyr for the steroid cause right now. So that was a big story, but I'm not clear if I understand why the government's doing what they're doing at this time. Then there's, of course, the Stephon Marbury Knicks meltdown, and I can't believe there was a time when I thought that the Celtics with Ainge were in worse shape than the Knicks with Isaiah. Isaiah has obviously made a complete mess of that situation, but some of Marbury's comments this week were some of the best entertainment value we got in sports this week, with Marbury implying that he had the goods on Isaiah, and then if Isaiah didn't start him, he would do a mob-style blackmail scheme against Isaiah. That kind of stuff was just great, crazy press. And then, of course, there was A-Rod and his negotiations, and I don't have a whole lot there that hasn't already been said, except for the fact that I'm fascinated by this fall from grace that Scott Boras, the super agent, has gone through. And it's just a really interesting study in negotiations and how, if you really want to be somewhere, sometimes you have to cut to the chase and just have that discussion and just cut out the middle person if you're not being represented properly. So it's just really interesting to watch those dynamics unfold. I guess I left that with a little more respect for A-Rod than I did have before, because a lot of people were like, well, you know, A-Rod calls all the shots, and so anything Boras did, he did with A-Rod's instruction. I think that's true, but I don't think A-Rod said to Boras, yeah, you got to leak this during the World Series game. I just think A-Rod trusts Boras enough to say, you handle this, and Boras handled it really badly. And I respect A-Rod for taking the time to take that back under his own control and try to make a deal happen. So we're going to have to see if my respect for A-Rod goes up. I still don't want him on my team, as I kind of said last week about these things. There are certain athletes I don't want on my team, and he's definitely still one of them. But I respected how he handled himself around that negotiation. So let's see. Are there any other real things I want to talk about this week? My chat guest has not returned. Sorry I started late, chat guest. Hopefully I'll find you next week. What else is there to talk about tonight? I have a blog entry I want to read you guys, so maybe I can do that before I close. Oh, yeah, Ricky Williams is back. I kind of have a soft spot for Ricky Williams. I think, you know, I'm a big fan of the possibility of redemption. There's this, you know, classic saying of, like, previous behavior is the best indicator of future behavior or what have you. And so the idea being that Ricky Williams is this flawed individual, and so that's going to wreck this new opportunity also through a relapse or what have you. But I kind of been pretty open and honest about his struggles with drugs, different medical cures he's tried, and the different retreats from civilized world he's taken to try to get a handle on himself. And I guess in a weird way, I'm rooting for Ricky. Maybe he can help the Dolphins win a game this season. I'm pretty psyched because I picked the Dolphins to cover the spread against Philly, and they did. So they're 0-10, but who knows? Maybe Ricky will make a difference for that pathetic franchise. So I talk a lot about the corporatization of sports and why I find it disturbing, but I wrote a blog entry that really kind of summed up my feelings, and so I think I'm going to close this week's broadcast by reading this particular entry, and then we'll do it again next week, and I look forward to hearing from you. Feel free to email me if you have anything you want me to cover next time around, and I'm going to try to do these every Sunday, and it's been a learning curve for me, so thanks for bearing with me. I've done a lot of podcasting in a different format, but this is the first kind of free-flowing podcasting I've done, and I still have some things to learn about it, but thanks for listening, and hopefully I can reward you with some decent broadcasts at different points going forward. So the blog entry is entitled, Why I'm a Bad Sport About Corporate Sponsorships. And I actually wrote it a couple of years ago, but really nothing has changed. There's a couple of topical references that don't really work anymore, so I think I might skip those when I reread this. I wrote at that time, so what's the problem with corporate sponsorship of sports anyway? The glib answer that sports and corporate sponsors doesn't ring true. True in the TiVo age, marketing departments are looking for more and more ways to embed advertising within all programs, and true, sports events are sitting ducks for this kind of embedded advertising. Sports executives have certainly made it clear they are more than willing to bend over for a few extra bucks in exchange for plastering a corporate logo on top of a free throw, timeout, or any other moment they can invent, package, and sell, like that dreaded game summary. Still not convinced that the sponsorship of sports is a tad excessive? Ladies and gentlemen, I bring you the Budweiser starting lineups. But that's not what's offensive. What's offensive is the very idea that corporations know anything about what it takes to excel as an athlete. On the surface, it might seem you could compare the corporate team at McDonald's or Pfizer to the sports team that just won a big game, but that's an absurd comparison. Every corporation has employees so mediocre they would drag down any championship sports team. No, the sponsorship of sports is not about bringing winners together. It's about something a lot more diabolical, the repositioning and rebranding of the corporate image. Corporations like to sponsor things that have more soul and spontaneity than they do. Corporations are vampires that sponsor cultural moments in order to mooch off the passion generated by individuals who are volatile, brave, and brilliant, all adjectives that can never be attributed to the average multinational enterprise. There is definitely something impressive about how large corporations succeed. The era of mass consumption is nothing if not a study in the creation and fulfillment of perceived human needs in the most efficient and profitable manner possible. But big companies succeed by using methods that have nothing to do with what it takes to excel in the field. Excelling as an athlete involves relentless discipline, passion, and a willingness to fail in the clutch, self in the spotlight, win or lose. Corporations never expose themselves that nakedly. Losing a lawsuit is just another bottom line expense anticipated in the financial statement. Every significant move a corporation makes has to be rubber stamped by a team of lawyers. There are no behind the back passes. Everything is run up the bureaucratic flagpole. By the time the board of directors can approve a three-point jump shot, the game is long since over. If sports teams had the ability to pluck players off rival teams and invent rules to disqualify up-and-coming opponents, then that would be a closer similarity between corporate business and sports. Just look at Microsoft, a company that expertly uses its size and market penetration to ensure that there is virtually no competition. Companies sponsor sports to imply that they love competition, but Microsoft hates competition so much they cut competitors off at the root. A company like Microsoft would never participate in a single elimination tournament, but it would not hesitate to sponsor one. Microsoft isn't used to playing fair. It has a 10-lap lead on its competition, and now it just has to keep pace. Integrating its web browser into the operating system was the basketball equivalent of putting 10 players towards the opponent's five and saying, let's play ball, Netscape. Does Microsoft win? Take skill? Yes. Is it real win or lose competition between evenly matched adversaries? Absolutely not. If you disagree, I've got the names and numbers of some software entrepreneurs with footprints of Microsoft on their neck to introduce you to. If corporations had to compete the way a sports team did, they'd be screwed. Their skill is winning from a position of strength. Their golf handicap starts them on the putting green. Nice putt, Walmart, but don't pump your chest like you drove the damn ball into the green yourself. I can hear the rebuttal now. Not correct, John. Companies have to succeed like athletes do. That's actually true of small, aggressive businesses that can't afford to sponsor the Olympics or hand out ridiculous oversized checks at the U.S. Open. But the obstacles faced by companies rich enough to sponsor major sporting events does not require breaking a sweat. Large corporations face the business challenge of increasing branding and market share through the strategic use of enormous advertising, product development, and human resource budgets. It takes a lot of skill, but it's about systems, not individual guts and grit. The only individual in a corporation that has any valid comparison to the elite athlete is the CEO. The CEO is the only person in the company whose performance rises and falls on a truly public stage, and who is remotely accountable for companies' failings in the eyes of the market. But CEOs don't sponsor sporting events, companies do. And while we're at it, most CEOs have no comparable incentive to win, given that their multi-million-dollar pay packages are rarely tied to performance in a way that has a downside. Fortunately, that's starting to change. It would be refreshing to see these top executives paying athletes price for losing. I've never seen a picture of a CEO crying after a tough financial report came out. I've met champions in business, but they're mostly people the public has never heard of. I've seen people work 7-day weeks and make unheard-of sacrifices to keep their business afloat, running up credit cards on faith. Who has more championship grit, those brave mom-and-pops who put all their business hopes on a credit card, or MasterCard, that mammoth sports sponsor, a company that wins regardless of whether a business racking up MasterCard debt makes good on that debt or not? Yep, I can't do anything about companies that link their names to slam dunks and stolen bases. They'll buy any sports moment they can, and they will find plenty of willing sellers amongst promiscuous sports executives. In fact, they've got their research teams in the labs right now, working overtime to invent new ways to chop up and sell sports by the minute. There isn't much a lone voice like me can do to shop the shilling. But at the very least, we can demystify what's happening and call it what it is, a shameful and cunning attempt to link the hearts of champions with the cold market calculations of multinational companies with little real competition. Okay, so that was a feel-good blog entry that summarizes the essence of why the corporate sponsorship of sports is so bothersome to me. And as I wrap this broadcast up, I see that our Celtics have climbed all the way back into this game with the Magic having been down 20 points. So it looks like there's going to be some good basketball action to wrap up here. And then the Bills-Patriots game tonight. I think the Bills are going to cover this enormous 17-point spread, but that's why they play the games. I don't see the Bills winning the game, but I see them covering the spread. I guess we're about to find out. So this wraps up my second edition of the Uncensored Week in Sports, and I hope you'll join me next week, Sunday, at 7 Eastern Time. Signing off, it's John Reed.